This month of February 2025, we have been searching for insights and greater understanding of the Theosophical movement here in Philadelphia, in particular, during this, our 100th anniversary year of the Philadelphia United Lodge of Theosophists. So we can clap for 100 years. So let's step back for a moment. We're told the Theosophical movement is one which has gone by many names in the past and will continue to do so in the future. So, how do we recognize the movement as we study its past and present as one of the second object of the Theosophical movement, second of three objects, is to study the historical and the history, the sciences, the mythologies, the religions of nations and civilizations, and to find where the Theosophical movement has been expressed, and to learn as much as we can about that in our effort to see it expressed in our own day. So how do we recognize the movement in past and present? And we could also ask the question, how will we know it when we see it in our future lives, it being embossed in the very soul of every human being? How will we know that it's expressed and identify with it? What are the signs of the Theosophical movement? Well, wherever thought has struggled to be free, wherever spiritual ideas, as opposed to forms and dogmatism, have been promulgated, there the Theosophical movement lives, moves, and has its being, as Mr. Judge says. We would say nowhere is that movement discerned with such clarity during the fourth quarter of the 18th century as in the 13 colonies generally, and in particularly the city of Philadelphia, with the influence of the Freemasons in their effort to found a nation based on principles where such a movement could flourish, where the Theosophical movement could flourish unhampered by the tyranny of the crown, unhampered by the superstition of the church, where it could flourish unhampered by the unprincipled mobs who will move in whatever direction the political winds may be blowing this week. Now, for us to get into the particulars of this, let's take a moment to consider these words of Mr. Judge. He says, wherever thought has struggled to be free. He said, the movement exists today. It existed yesterday. It will exist tomorrow. Its unity, its prevalence do not subsist in having a single organization or multiple organizations or any organization at all. The Theosophical movement simply is. So we're going to take a few minutes here first to grasp a bird's eye view of the historical record and the universal purview of the Theosophical movement, known by many names throughout history, from the ancients as it moves forward in time to root itself in the city of Philadelphia. So we've heard of the ancient wisdom and her schools, which are often called the mystery schools or just the mysteries by some. These schools flourished among all the civilizations of antiquity. We commonly think of the ancient wisdom in association with Greece, India, and Egypt. The principal mysteries celebrated among the Greeks were the Eleusinian and the Samothracian. Additionally, there were associations of philosophers who should be included with these philosophical schools, the most important of which were the Pythagorean school at Crotona and the Platonic school in Athens. The mystery schools, these were all over the world throughout time. The mystery schools of the Chaldeans were the rites of Ishtar and Tammuz. The Persian schools were called the Magian, as in Magi. These are founded upon the teachings of Zoroaster. The Mithraic cult arose from the Magian rites and was celebrated in Rome, which were also brought by the Roman legion to England and to France. In Europe, the Druidic mysteries were celebrated in England, Ireland, and Gaul. Gaul, which is now parts of France, Belgium, Luxembourg, Germany, Switzerland, and northern Italy. The Druidic mysteries actually combined doctrines that are found in both Chaldean and Buddhistic sources. The Odinic or Gothic rites were found in Scandinavian and Germanic countries. They were founded by one Prince Sig, also known as Odin, who it is said migrated there from the Mesopotamian region. Okay. Egypt. The principal mystery cults of Egypt were the rites of Isis, Osiris, and Horus. The rites of Serapis in Alexandria, with which we would also mention the eclectic school of theosophy, known today as the Neoplatonists in Alexandria. These flourished until around 400 AD, when the last of the Neoplatonists fled Alexandria. In Syria, the most important school was the Essene, and similar to them were the Nazarenes and the Therapeutae. Several mystical sects arose among the Jews after the Mosaic mysteries, the most significant of which was the Kabbalistic Jews, which had its beginning during the Roman conquest of Judea. Christianity was celebrated as a mystery during the first 3 centuries of the faith. And among those organizations are the Gnostics and the followers of Marcion. Among the Arabs, institutions of initiation rose under the patronage of Islam. The dervishes and Sufis are examples of these societies. Buddhist mysteries were performed in the caverns of Septaparna by the early Arhats of Aryavarta, and important Brahminical initiations existed at Ellora and the caves of Elephanta. The mysteries are still celebrated in Tibet and Mongolia under the general title of Lamaism. China has its Taoist doctrines, where initiations are actually individual efforts of self-discipline and self-realization. Shinto and Buddhist rites are still celebrated in Japan, and indeed contain elements that are present in the school of ancient Greece. In ancient America, the ancient wisdom flourished among the Inca, the Aztec, and the North American tribes. The Great Medicine Lodge of Ojibwe is an example of a North American mystery school. The rites of Hubalba, practiced in Guatemala, are a type of mystery teaching. Shamanism was a powerful force throughout Siberia, and the Alaskan Indians and Eskimos, the Inuit, received their teachings from, it is said, from Asian nomads. So we can say that no age and no civilization has been without its expression of the theosophical movement. Of more modern origin are the Illuminati, the Rosicrucians, the Alchemists, and the Freemasons. All these orders appeared in the 16th and 17th century in Europe. But in current times, they have largely fallen away from the ancient wisdom. HPB has something to say about this. She says, "It may thus be shown that modern Freemasonry descends in direct line from initiated Gnostics, Neoplatonists, and hierophants of the pagan mysteries, all the ancients, the secrets of which they have lost, but which nevertheless were preserved by those who would not compromise." She says if the Masons are willing to forget their history, the history of their true origin, the Theosophists are not willing to do so. Indeed, elsewhere, HPB tells us that Freemasonry, whether they know it or not, is and has been the repository of the many customs, ritual traditions, and initiations of past orders of the ancient wisdom. Furthermore, we've read that having membership in several Eastern fraternities and esoteric brotherhoods, HPB has knowledge in common with all Eastern members of her brotherhood, knowledge of everything connected with what we know as Western Freemasonry. This can be learned in her articles on the roots of ritualism in the church and Masonry. Indeed, she writes of numberless false, deceptive teachings that were imposed upon Freemasonry, in particular during the period 1825 to 1875. Okay, but we're not talking about the period in the 1800s. We're talking about 1776 now, before that happened. It's 1776 to which we turn our attention now. This is a time when Mr. Judge writes, he says, Freemasonry was a great and important part of the true Theosophical movement. Full stop. Considering this fact, we may now have a better appreciation for the presence and influence of Freemasonry in Philadelphia, which is to say, we may have a better appreciation for the presence and influence of the ancient wisdom in Philadelphia, which of course is to say, we may have a better appreciation for the Theosophical movement in Philadelphia. The three are one, going by different names. And we may have more of an appreciation now for the role of the Theosophical adepts, that the role that they played in their guidance of the founding fathers. Let's now take a look at some of the ways that the adepts involved themselves in the affairs of Philadelphia during this time period in the years around 1776. First, we might reflect on the status that dogmatic creedal religion played in the Western world generally at this point in time and for the previous 1800 years. The mind of the Western world was entirely structured with the framework of an external faith savior who could only be reached through the church, a church in which heresy was condemned, free thinking, independent thinking, heresy, and heretics were persecuted. Well, if that's the dominant force among thinkers during this time, how is it that neither the Declaration of Independence nor the Constitution of the United States have any notion of adherence to such a religion? The teaching is that the exclusion of such references to church and religion was due to the Theosophical adepts. It was they who oversaw the drafting of the Declaration of Independence. They oversaw the drafting of the Constitution. Now, for instance, the words nature and nature's God are referred to. But this is a philosophical reference to the divine in nature and entirely outside the catechesis of the church that holds their God as external to nature. Indeed, supernatural. Indeed, Article 6 even says that no religious test as a qualification for office shall ever be required, and the First Amendment also prohibits the establishment of a government church or the restraint of the free exercise of religion. Government's completely out of it. So that's one example in the Constitution and the Bill of, or the Declaration. Another one is that with the help of Benjamin Franklin, the adepts were able to influence Thomas Paine to come to America, where his talents were needed to inspire change in the hearts and minds of the colonists. Yes, indeed, in the direction of separating from England, which would result in the revolution. Now, we're not told that Benjamin Franklin was conscious that he was helping the adepts, but such may have been the case as he was in France, and we know he interacted with Comte Saint-Germain. Judge writes that at the suggestion of George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, and Thomas Jefferson, and other Freemasons, whose minds, through the teachings of the symbolic degrees of Masonry, were fitted to reason correctly, Thomas Paine wrote Common Sense, without which, Judge goes on, the Revolutionary War would never have happened. Paine tells us in his writings that he had what he called two distinct classes of thoughts. There were those produced by his own reflection, and then there were those thoughts that bolt into his mind of their own accord, which he refers to as voluntary visitors. The voluntary visitors were injected into his brain by the Theosophical Adepts. The results of Paine's efforts, such as the pamphlet Common Sense, writes Judge, was the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. Paine would write in his publishings that no beginning could be made in Asia, Africa, or Europe to reform the political condition of man. America made a stand not for herself alone, but for the world, and she looked beyond the advantage that she could receive. Judge wrote of this period in American history, whereof the adepts hovered over Washington, Jefferson, and all the other brave Freemasons who dared to found a free government in the West. The adepts cleared their minds, inspired their pens, and left upon the great seal of this mighty nation the memorial of their presence. And of course, we all have seen the Great Seal a million times on the back of the dollar bill. So, all right, so that's another example. Another example of the influence that the Adepts had during 1776 in Philadelphia. Judge says, allow me to point to a historical fact in connection with Count Saint-Germain, which will shed some light on the question of what, if any, connection do some adepts have with justifiable revolutions. One of the well-known generals, he says, who fought with Washington in the Continental Army against the British was General Frederick Wilhelm von Steuben, a Prussian. In 1777 in Paris, and at the same, what Yeah, in 1777, he was in Paris, and at the same time, the Count Saint-Germain was the Minister of War in Paris. They were well acquainted with each other, and the Count induced von Steuben to come to America and offer his sword to General Washington. Now, how would Saint-Germain know that, other than what we know about what adepts were able to do among themselves? So, to go offer his sword to General Washington. Von Steuben did so, was gladly received by Washington, and did splendid service in the cause of liberty. Everybody knows that Saint-Germain was an adept, and the fact above detailed, he says, is set forth in many publications and letters of authentic force. So what did von Steuben do? He was sent to Valley Forge at a time when the Continental Army was a combination of a bunch of militia guys who were not professional soldiers and were in danger of falling apart. Von Steuben brought them together, trained them to be the proper Continental Army, and this group, who had never won a battle yet, went on to cross the Delaware with General Washington and won the first battle that they fought since then. Von Steuben is known for, even today in the Army, for drill and ceremony. Many of the moves that he created are still used in ceremonial drills in the Army. And other things, such as his military manual, von Steuben's regulations of the order and discipline of troops of the United States continues to be an influence in the United States Army manuals. It's called the Blue Book. Indeed, von Steuben, sent by Saint-Germain, ended up being the first drill sergeant of the United States, essentially. Okay, so we have this confluence of events looking in from outside kind of made no sense, but this militia type Continental Army developed in short order to defeat the greatest military in the world. So these are some of the examples of the influence of Freemasonry in Philadelphia. Let's move forward a little bit. Because in 1873, HPB landed in New York. And she went from New York, she moved to Philadelphia. And she lived there for a time until 1874. Now, we haven't found too much written about what she did, what was her life like. Not too much written about the people who she knew. But she was there for a while. She was sick. We don't need to get into all of this. But what we have read is that during her time in Philadelphia, and let's think about this. Philadelphia, in recent weeks, we learned about William Penn and his family of Quakers, who moved to Philadelphia, which indeed is considered a part of the Theosophical movement. So we have this influence or impulse by Quakers inviting all people of all religions all the way back in the 1600s, in particular during the fourth quarter of the 17th century. The influence was established by the Freemasons. In 1776, or by the Quakers. In 1776, another influence by the Freemasons in the fourth quarter of the 18th century, the influence and impulse was established. And then when HPB arrived in New York, she was there for a time, but then moved to Philadelphia. Was she there also to establish an impulse in Philadelphia and the presence of the Theosophical movement? Did she participate in ways in the Theosophical movement in Philadelphia? Well, this student would say, would give a resounding yes, because it was while she was in Philadelphia, she says, that she was inspired to create, to establish the Theosophical movement. And she moved back to New York City to establish it. And of course, we all know it was established in 1875 at the beginning of the fourth quarter of the 19th century. And we will bring up just a few decades later, when we're talking about the Theosophical movement in the city of Philadelphia. So HPB moves back after having been here, beginning at the fourth quarter of the 19th century. And it was just a few decades later when a Quaker family, Quaker in the spirit of William Penn, learned about theosophy in their own way. Who's to say what it was? But this Quaker family began their search. And their search led them in particular to the United Lodge of Theosophists in New York. And for years, this family would travel by train every week to the ULT in New York to become grounded in the principles of the philosophy and to eventually begin a study group and then finally a lodge. And this Quaker family was the founding family of the United Lodge of Theosophists in February of 1925. So the reading that was given by Krishna, we felt had a pertinent application during 1776 because of such condemnation and, or we should say, oppression by the crown. We'll just repeat that and then open the floor for contributions and questions. So he says, Krishna is speaking, I produce myself among creatures. Who is I? Is I Krishna or is I the spirit of the Theosophical movement? I produce myself throughout time. I produce myself among creatures, O son of Bharata, whenever there is a decline of virtue and an insurrection of vice and injustice in the world. And thus I incarnate from age to age for the preservation of the just, the destruction of the wicked, and the establishment of righteousness. The floor is open for questions and contributions and discussion. SL.
It's interesting that HPB began to get a more formal idea of the idea of the Theosophical Society as an organization while she was in Philadelphia. And we recall an article by Judge where he said that the very association we call the Theosophical Society was founded based on the Freemasons. In other words, their idea of an open lodge, all-inclusive, universal brotherhood, open to all, whoever belonged to one belonged to all, was for the Theosophical Society was directly influenced by the lodges of the Freemasons.
Thank you for the contribution. Yes, as we say in the Declaration, without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. Now we can say that even back in the 1700s, something that was absolutely unheard of. From Masonic lodges in the 1700s welcomed people of all faiths. Of course, was it absolutely universal? They didn't allow women. We all know this. However, they allowed Muslims, Jews, Hindus, all faiths were allowed, and that was a radical place to be. In the spirit of that, the ULT, of course, and the Theosophical Society is open to all people without condition, and the ULT is without charging a fee. It's just free and open to the public. For what? For the purpose of broadcasting the teachings of Theosophy as recorded in the writings of HPB and Mr. Judge. Theosophy Hall, you had a question?
Yes, go ahead.
We hear all the time about the connection between the Freemasons and ULT. So we know what the teachings are from ULT, but do the Masons have, I mean, do they have classes? I mean, what do, because it was just said about all the different religions that are welcome to the Masons. So do they actually have teachings like ours then?
So, do the Freemasons have teachings, a philosophical teaching? Our understanding is that the teachings of Freemasonry, the purpose of the fraternity today, is more along the line of teaching ethics and morality. The end goal is to help men become better fathers, to become better workers, better leaders, and better co columns of their community. That's the end goal in Freemasonry. That's our understanding. Now, HPB says, we don't know if we mentioned this, but she said having membership in Eastern fraternities and esoteric brotherhood, she has in knowledge in common with all Eastern members of the brotherhoods. She has in knowledge of everything connected with what we know of Western Freemasonry. And we will say she wrote that theosophists, she actually said Eastern occultists, but we read that as theosophists, of course, have the obligation to learn everything that they can about Freemasonry. She actually put that in writing. So one is encouraged to do your studies. And there's plenty that's written in the philosophy. From what we've found, the more of the philosophy we study, we've read some of Freemasonry, but the philosophy is, as opposed to today's Freemasonry, is just a hundredfold. It's a different plane. It really is. But there's nothing wrong with the study of Freemasonry, as we said, as HBB mentions. We also will mention that the intent of the founders was that theosophical societies would operate as the Masonic lodges do, which is to say, Masonic lodges in every country, and in the United States, they're in every state, because originally the colonies were in their own individual country. So Masonic lodges of each country are their own authority. There is no worldwide Masonic authority. There is no people who were voted to control the Masons all over the world. That's how Masonry is established. Each and every state or country is expected to interact in brotherly ways along a common line of common aims and purposes. That was the vision that Mr. Judge talked about for the Theosophical Society. But that vision did not occur. It did not happen within the Theosophical Society. The Theosophical Society has always remained under the authority of a president. And that was not the original intention. However, when the ULT was founded, Mr. Crosby very definitely had the intention of making each ULT independent of each other, having a similarity of aim, teaching, and purpose. And the declaration starts off with that sentence: "The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy." That's independence as an individual and independence for each lodge. So thank you for the question. JCS.
So the premise is that all of these leaders around 1776, they were all Freemasons. I've often read that they were deists, and I was wondering if there's an interchange between those two terms.
Thank you for the question. It's an important question. And not all the signers of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution were Freemasons. However, the philosophy of Freemasonry is deism, and other men also were de now. So here is the premise for deism. Okay, deism is very close. The way it was understood and practiced in 1776 was very close to the philosophy of theosophy in terms of everything operates according to law. However, stop. They believed back then in this great architect of the universe. To the degree that they may or may not have personalized that. Now, the great architect of the universe, which Mr. Judge refers to, the student of theosophy recognizes that as the synthesis of the combination of seven layers of intelligence all as one. The analogy that's used by Freemasonry is that this great architect of the universe was like a clockmaker. The clock was built, set in motion, and left to itself to operate according to the law of clocks. So that's really what it has in common. And this influence of deism, which is the philosophy of the Freemasons at the time, we couldn't say that today. But this philosophy of deism is what inculcated, which was inculcated in the philo in the in the in the in the Constitution. Maybe not inculcated, but we could say the Constitution was written by men with a philosophical basis of deism and guided by the adepts with their pens as they wrote. Thank you for the question. It's a very important one. SL.
We had two thoughts, but just first, that another connection between the adepts and the regents and the masons is that in the last quarter of the 17th century, which is around the time we're talking about, the four agents of the adepts in Europe at that time. Were Saint-Martin, Saint-Germain, Mesmer, and Cagliostro. And where did they all meet? One time in their life they all met was at the Masonic Convention
In France.
in Europe. Excuse me?
In Paris, is that right?
In Europe, in Paris, yes. So there was a de definite connection. And it seems to this student that even to today, within Freemasonry, there is a profound understanding of their connection with the Theosophical movement. And we say that because the Freemasons in Philadelphia and the Masonic Temple is arguably the oldest in the United States. There might be
Yes, it
some
is.
disagreement, but certainly one of the original ones. And yet through all those all that time, they had, although they accepted individuals from all creeds, all religions. They had never allowed an outside organization to present a program or to speak as a group inside their temple. And the first exception to that on their part was when they allowed the United Lodge of Theosophists to have an interlodge symposium with the lodges of Philadelphia, New York and Washington, D.C., in the early 1980s at the Masonic Temple. And not only that, they gave us a very nice lunch and guided tour of the facility, the first time in their history that they opened up that much. So we think the recognition is on both sides.
Yes, that's very true. We would just correct one thing. It wasn't in the 1980s. It was actually around 2005. And yeah, that's right. And what was interesting, the executive director of the Masonic Temple at the time said to us that consideration was on the table of their board for some time to open it to the right types of organizations so that the temple could be used for elevated reasons, not to rent it out as a conference center for corporations. But their ideas was maybe universities would have, so it was trying to open to the public. And when we presented the periodical and had a discussion about the ULT, the executive director said, "This is exactly what we're looking for." And he invited us as the ULT as the first, yes, as the first conference to be held there, other than Freemasons. And yeah, there were Freemasons from everywhere, from California, from Canada, et cetera, et cetera. It was a wonderful conference, very interesting. And afterwards, we will add one of the Masons said, "You know, I don't really understand what was going on, but I know that something good was going on." Okay. Yes, MDW and then Theosophy Hall.
Well, it seems that one of the characteristics of Freemasonry in general is that it's steeped in symbolism and ritual. You know, that we, from what we see publicly, that there's certain characteristics. So we always wondered, is this perhaps symbolic of ancient rituals that took place in the temple?
So what about the symbols and rituals that go on in Freemasonry? Well, you know, HPB actually states that the Freemasons, actually their rituals, and they have many, many different organizations of Freemasonry, are the repositories of symbols and rituals and initiations from sects long gone by. These symbols found their way into Freemasonry. Now, and let's recognize that a ritual is a symbol. It's a symbol that is acted. In ancient times, the purpose of a ritual was not necessarily to bestow some kind of sainthood on the person being initiated, although it influenced him, but there was it was a play, it was theater, it was drama that was presented in a way so that the thoughtful could reflect on what they were seeing. Each individual in the ritual reflected a principle, and the inter as opposed to just having like a family TV show. No. These plays had purpose. We wondered, we couldn't say about the rituals of Freemasonry today, other than, as we said in the philosophy, it's written that they are a repository of the old, and the purpose of them originally in the ancient times was to be used so that people could learn more about themselves. So we could consider that. Yes, the Theosophy Hall.
So there is a hand here, and there's also a chat that's been up for a little while.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Okay. So one understanding of the Freemasons is that one of the privileges for belonging is protection from the consequences of your actions and to bring relief to certain brothers. Murder and treason included. So, how might that affect us karmically? Are they just delaying the karma of their actions?
We couldn't say. Yeah, I mean, if that's the case, I mean, what they're saying in Freemasonry today is not part of our purview. We couldn't say. We can't speak to it, really.
So the
So there's a
chat.
chat. Yeah, could you read the chat, please?
Yeah, the chat is basically simply, does Freemasonry teach reincarnation?
We have never seen any documentation that Freemasonry teaches reincarnation. However, Freemason is open to all people of all faiths and religions. The only requirement, some people think the requirement is that you have to believe, there's one requirement that you have to believe, one religious requirement that you have to believe in a personal God. That's not the truth. You have to believe that all comes from the same source. And that opens Freemasonry to all people of all faiths, except, of course, the atheist who does not believe in God. And so the justification is if one doesn't believe that we all come from a common source, then that individual cannot experience true brotherhood. It can't be done if he doesn't accept that we're all one in essence.
Could we make a quick comment?
Please.
So HPB's stay here was less than a year, most of a year, but less than a year. She wrote a whole chapter in The Secret Doctrine on Keeley, John W. Keeley, and his basically perpetual motion machine. And she actually, one of the addresses of the letters that she wrote was 1111 Girard Avenue, which was with walking distance of Keeley's lab, which is it was the 25th and Ridge. So that's one thing we were sure. Well, she obviously met Keeley, and the other thing is the physician who attended her was Seth Pankost, who later was a vice president of the Theosophical Society, and he comes from a distinguished family. And he also had, he was a Kabbalist, and he had the largest, apparently had the largest occult library in the States.
Thank you. Yes, MDW.
So, in the public eye today, we see much derision of like the Illuminati, you know, these kind of expressions. We're just sort of confused, you know. I guess they're a definition of the Illuminati are different than what we are expressing here now.
Well, as was said, the ancient wisdom, the Theosophical movement, has gone by different names throughout history. And, you know, when it becomes, when an organization is so graced to be a bona fide vehicle for it, it's not so forever. So who knows when, where, or why, you know, these Illuminatis or Rosicrucians, however they are said to be a part of the Theosophical movement, at a certain time in their history, there was an influence and a beneficence that the work of those people did that was a bona fide part of the Theosophical movement, just as Martin Luther was, just as the Rosicrucians were. Where they are today, that very definitely is an individual study for each theosophist to find the answers to his questions. And it would really help if first we are well grounded in the principles of theosophy so that we have something to compare those teachings to and see the similarities and recognize the differences and make the decision for ourselves. How much time are we going to spend studying these things? By all means, the study of ancient philosophies and religions and mythologies are the second object of the Theosophical movement. So we do not mean to downplay it. But the purpose of the study is so that we can learn and grow from the study rather than get too involved in trying. Well, so, but that's to be left to each to himself. Yes, Theosophy Hall.
There's any possibility that HPB and Isaac Meyer could have met when Isaac Meyer was writing about the Kabbalah before anybody else. He was allegedly connected with Masonry and is buried at Laurel Hill Cemetery. And he's referenced in the Secret Doctrine.
Isaac Meyer, is there any documentation that HPB met with Isaac Meyer, a rabbi, right?
Right. Well, you know, it's a good question because it brings up something in the life of HPB. Things like this are important for the student to research for himself. If the question comes to mind, take the time and search. However, we in the lodge, with the time that we spend in the lodge, have to ask the question, if we are promulgating the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy, how much time are we going to put into the minutiae of somebody that she might have met in the book. You know, that is important to the individual if he decides it's important. However, the time we spend in the lodge has to be based on really the theosophical movement and the promulgation of the principles in the cause of the masters. Yes, SL.
Well, that I think takes us right around to the initial reading from the Gita, the natural cycle of forms, organizations, institutions, whatever they are, eventually reaches a point of decay, injustice, vice, death, and what brings it back to life or brings about a new form is that I that Krishna refers to, whether it's divine wisdom or the spiritual influence. So, as was just said, our emphasis is to recognize that which is permanent and unchanging, eternal, the spiritual truths, and not focus, unless it's personal interest, too much time on the transient personalities and institutions and so forth.
Thank you. And with that, we will mention the Theosophical Society, founded by HPB, Mr. Judge and Mr. Alcott, which served its purpose in the modern as a modern day embryo of this rendition of the theos or of this cycle of the Theosophical movement. And whereas we could say that that purpose is not limited today to the Theosophical Society. The spreading of the principles of philosophy, according to HPB and Mr. Judge in particular, may or may not be an object of any one particular Theosophical Society. So there's no judgment on the part of a student of the ULT, because we all know there must be many dedicated students who belong to theosophical societies, who put forth the effort to learn and to teach and to spread broadcast these teachings. However, that is the issue. The issue is not for us to spend any time today on the Theosophical Society, because really the Theosophical movement has moved beyond it. Has not moved beyond some of the people in it, but it's moved beyond the society, with all due respect. So, with that, we're at the hour, and we thank you for attending. We'll see you at our Karma, our class on Karma in the Ocean of Theosophy, on Wednesday evening. Thank you.